Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 738.1S0819, certificate number 13747. Loyalists.
Oh, say, do you see what I see? Congress sitting here in sweet serenity. I could cheer, the reason's clear. For the first time in a year, Adams isn't here.
This is Loyalists with a capital L. This is not just Loyalists in the general, in the sense of somebody who insists that the last season of Game of Thrones was good or liked the Star Wars prequels.
Last season of Game of Thrones was good.
I agree. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that concludes Loyalists entry.
It's a great indie rock band name, Loyalists, with no the.
Well, I feel like loyalism is a thing that comes up in indie rock fans. You know, people who think that are you somebody who thinks that only the Twin Tone Replacements records were good, or would a true loyalist stick with them through the Warner Brothers records? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, for sure.
Just the sense of being a ride or die fan of somebody.
Do you only listen to Death Cab with Chris Walla? And as soon as Chris Walla's out, it's not a band anymore. You don't believe in it?
But this is Loyalists in a more specific sense, capital L. And I'm reluctant to even use the name for the show because that's the kind of self-justifying, propagandizing name they gave themselves. It's the equivalent of saying pro-life.
Right.
Which newspapers don't tend to say, because again, if you call yourselves pro-life, it means all your enemies are in favor of death. All your ideological opponents just like death.
Agreed.
Which is why all my opinions are pro-life.
That's right.
I'm just a pro-good politician, and everybody who disagrees with me obviously is bad idea.
I believe that all of our listeners understand that our opinions are good. Everyone else's opinions that don't conform to ours, even minutely don't conform, are bad.
Here's the genius of
bad,
it. Here's why podcasting is the perfect medium for us. Like, in the far future, our opponents' ideas have not survived.
Right.
Our opinions, being the only ones left, are self-justifyingly the correct ones.
The
most correct ones, exactly. Mm-hmm. Be excellent to each other. And so we don't even have to do any kind of research or spirited philosophical defense, because there's nothing for us to argue against. We're the only game in town.
But what do we do about the fact that we often paper over our minute disagreements by just not, we know where those borderlands are, and we just kind of skate over.
Well, you didn't hear me say how much I liked the post Chris Walla Death Cab records, because I knew it would be getting into dicey territory.
You know what? I like them too. No, I mean, you know, there's
a
little bit.
I also enjoyed the last season of Game of Thrones.
I like Game of Thrones.
Bran the Broken should be the king.
Would you believe I just started rewatching Game of Thrones?
That's not such a weird thing to. That's not an. Are you kidding, John? Are you shitting me? You're rewatching the most popular television show of the last 10 years. Now that it's having a resurgence in popularity due to a sequel.
I am not a rewatcher of things,
right,
except
right,
for
right,
30
right.
Rock. It's the only thing I've ever rewatched.
I forgot you're a non-rewatcher.
I don't rewatch because I don't, you know, my daughter is...
Life's too short. I'm right. A non-rewatcher because life's too short.
Life's too short.
For 10 years, I've been meaning to rewatch The Shield, and I now believe I never will rewatch The Shield.
There you go. I've never watched it in the first place, so I'm safe from
you've
that.
You've still got a chance.
My kid is a fast reader, and I'm a slow reader. And so when I read a book, I really read the shit out of that book. You know, like I read every word, and I'm one of those people that reads to the end of a sentence and goes, what now? And goes back to that sentence and reads it again and then reads it a third time. So it takes me weeks and months to read books.
I'm starting to see why you didn't have a prep a show for today.
And she will read a book in two days or a day.
Just propelled through it.
Yeah. And I'm like, honey, what can you possibly have? You know, that was a 300-page book. How could you have possibly read it in 2 days? But this started when she first started reading. So I watched her evolve as a reader. And what I came to understand is then she rereads it. And she'll read a book three times.
Each time getting a little more.
Yeah. And I don't know I don't know how she's scanning over. But this was one of those, like, do you have an inner voice or not kind of things where I started to ask people, are you a fast reader or a slow reader? And it's crazy how many fast readers there are.
I'm a fast reader.
You're a fast reader.
Yeah.
And do you reread?
I think my retention suffers. As a kid, I would reread. I would reread my favorite books all the time. Now, not so much, just because of on Life's Too Short grounds.
Like, I've only ever reread two or three books. And it's because I don't know, I spent so much time reading
the Quran in prison.
That's right. The entire Encyclopedia Britannica.
Do you feel like your kid has good retention, or do you think she's kind of glossing through it, but you know, later she'll get more out of it?
No, it's incredible. She read A Wrinkle in Time, and she read it
A Wrinkle in record time,
and she read it really fast. And I was like, look, when I was your age, I read A Wrinkle in Time, and it spooked me and it messed me up in weird ways. So you cannot possibly have read that book in 2 days.
Yeah,
tell me the story of A Wrinkle in Time, and she broke it down for me in
freestyle rap.
And it was complete. She had the complete book, and you know, but wasn't spooked by it. Mm. Like, she just retold the story as a kind of, she retold it as a narrative. And I wonder, you know, second, third time through, and I don't know why I was spooked by it.
No, it's a creepy, it's an unwholesome kind of book. All those are, I think.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, people are different. Maybe she's immune to that vibe and finds something else in it.
She's a dark girl. She says it all the time.
Like she has a dark soul.
Yeah. She's like, even at 11 years old, she's like, I think I'm going to be goth. And I'm like, please, no, not goth. The only thing worse is dating skaters.
Don't say that if you're a parent. That just makes them zero in on goth.
I know.
But,
so you're a fast reader. I guess that makes sense.
I am. And I do find that like my retention suffers, but it really is just kind of like I'm propelling through this book at a certain speed. And if something's good enough, it'll grab me.
I see.
It'll okay, book, grab me. Not this scene. Hey, this is pretty good.
So when you read Tolstoy, you're just like flip.
I actually like reading older stuff because it does force me to slow down a little just because of the, you know, especially in translation, it might be a 100-year-old translation. And so the voice is a little antiquated and it's probably good for me.
What about when somebody describes a summer day for 50 pages?
Yeah, I really... The thing about a book like that is I keep going through it at a constant speed, just taking nothing out of it. Like, when is this part going to end?
Right.
Like, you know, there's 150 pages on Waterloo at the beginning of Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, and I read every word, and I don't think I remember any of it, but I put in my time. You
yeah,
know?
That's right. If you ever want to know about Waterloo, you and I can talk offline.
My dad turned into a nothing but a rewatcher, I don't know, maybe in his 50s or 60s, where he pretty much only enjoys the media he is.
Really?
Already enjoyed earlier in life. Yeah. I mean, not fully. I mean, I see him playing Skyrim and I assume he wasn't doing that in the 50s, but.
Has he rewatched Gunsmoke all the way through?
Well, I mean, he's even when the boomers do watch new content, it's basically rewatching because they're watching NCIS or some show that's the same every night, you know, like, let's see Mark Harmon crack the case in 48 minutes. You know, that it's basically rewatches.
Yeah, I guess that.
So right. I'm eagerly waiting to turn rewatching years old, and then I'm finally gonna see The Shield again and figure out what all of Dutch and Claudette's B stories were that I've forgotten. It'll be new to me.
The first episode of Game of Thrones, I was stunned at how much happens in the first episode. Like Jon Snow is, spoiler alert, he's already headed up to the wall. Episode one, Bran's already fallen off the, you know, like everything's already set in motion.
I guess at the time they had 2,000 pages of stuff to get to, and they were like, "We gotta move."
Yeah.
Later on, maybe they were regretting that.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I thought all of that took the whole first season to unfold. But anyway,
Well, 8 minutes later, I have not said actually what the loyalists should be called.
Oh, right, right, right. They should be called the Teddy Boys.
They were called mods and rockers. Their opponents called them Kingsmen, or more familiarly, Tories.
Kingsmen was not a very good movie.
Are you going to rewatch The Kingsmen?
I don't think so.
Or the sequel or the prequel? So I mean, the Kingsmen were also the Shakespearean troupe that performed his plays. But this just meant people loyal to the House of Hanover.
So are they the precursor to the modern Tories?
No, I mean, in the sense, this is a New World usage of Whig and Tory, whereas Whig meant a patriot, somebody devoted to, in this case, the cause of American independence.
Oh, this was an American story.
Yeah. The Tories are the sticks in the mud. Not Tory in the modern sense of a British prime minister who's like 70 points underwater in the polls or whatever she is right now. As we record this, I believe she's in a near tie with Vladimir Putin. She's in a statistical tie with Vladimir Putin for likability.
Even though this episode will come out just a matter of a few weeks.
Yeah, you're going to hear this in 3 weeks when Boris Johnson is prime minister again. And the rest of you in 2,000 years when Boris Johnson is on all the money still.
Yeah, right.
In the ruins.
No, it's going to be whatever his name, Jeremy Corbyn.
Who's the new Jeremy Corbyn? I am the new number two.
Well, you know, it's a Labour candidate, right? Isn't there about to be a Labour government?
I don't think so. Yeah. Just because of the oddities of their parliamentary system. If there were an election today, there would absolutely be a Labour government, but I don't think the Conservatives are going to call for that snap election. No, I was in Boston last week.
Oh, right.
Speaking at a university.
You sent me a picture standing on a Smoot measurement.
I wandered into Smoots. I started the day looking at Christian Science stuff very eagerly. I finally went to the Maparium, which is their hollow earth stained glass globe that you can stand inside, because that was what Mary Baker Eddy wanted.
Yeah.
On her deathbed, she was like, put tourists inside a stained glass globe and don't give me aspirin.
Did you feel healed?
I really enjoyed the vibe of the Christian Science Mother Church. It really reminds me, it's basically Temple Square in Salt Lake City, but what if it was in Boston in this kind of massive, kind of Romanesque building with a brutalist, extension on it?
But aren't areas behind successive curtains that you can't go unless you're a 33rd degree?
No, it's not about the religious practice there, although they do have services there. It's just because it's got a tourist facing plaza, then it's all the come learn about our history.
Oh, yeah.
The 19th century weird part, don't worry so much about it. Here's a newspaper we used to publish.
That was a good newspaper.
They really lean into the newspaper. Have you ever been to the Mother Church?
I have not. But, you know, my family was very close with Kay Fanning, longtime editor of the Christian Science
Book. I remember when we did the show.
Yeah. So,
a lot of interactive things where you can click on a front page of the Christian Science Monitor and it just shows a progressive headline like Mandela's free, Berlin Wall comes down, and you're like, wow, the Christian Science Monitor sure is, you know, always on the side of right, but it's, you know, they just leave off all the headlines. Like, right. They have almost every year, and then there's no 2016, 2017. I was like, oh, good thing nothing politically happened in America in 2016 or 2017 that might angry up tourists. Let's leave those years off of the display. Anyway, I just started walking kind of randomly toward the Charles River, not realizing I was about to hit Smoots.
Yeah.
So I took pictures of Smoots for the Patreon.
You put them on the Patreon. Well done.
Yeah, you got to pay to see me with Smoots, John.
So what
like, not every peon gets to see me taking a selfie, an awkward selfie with Trent. You know how hard it is to take a selfie with
the ground?
Graffiti on pavement? Yeah. Anyway, the next day I had the day off, and it was just a beautiful fall day in Boston, foliage turning red and yellow. Mm. Just gorgeous, gorgeous weather. And you know what I had never done is I had never walked the Freedom Trail.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the core of modern Bostonian tourism.
Right. One if by land, two if by sea.
They cleverly have laid a series of bricks. The future will not know about this. Boston, the seat of many historic events in the founding of our country.
Will be well underwater.
It is now underwater. There's a line of bricks that kind of leads you on a 2 or 3 mile amble through the city. Depending on which brochure you have, somewhere between 15 and 30 historic sites.
I've never done it either. I've walked over the Freedom Trail and gone, huh, That's something to do.
Look at
one
these
day.
Losers listening to this guy in a tricorn hat. Yeah, you kept crossing it. No, I studiously walked the whole thing from Boston Common all the way. You cross the river again up into Charlestown and wind up on Bunker Hill.
Yeah.
Where there's a big obelisk. But it's good. It's you know, if you want to, I went into the Old North Church, one if by land, two if by sea.
Which was it?
Went again? Aboard the it turned out to be two. Spoilers.
Two if by sea.
I like how you think this might come up.
That's why they ran up or they ran around.
Are you afraid a man on a horse is going to run up to you and be like, John, which is it? I got lost. I went aboard the USS Constitution. You know, but there's a lot of history, graveyards, and the oldest office building in America, which by the way, now Chipotle.
No.
The brochure doesn't say. The brochure just says, this is where Thoreau's publisher was. It's the oldest office building in America. It's now Chipotle.
I just learned that Chipotle's are not franchised.
Really?
It's the largest non-franchise fast food business in America.
That means corporate owns and operates all of them.
Corporate owns and operates every Chipotle.
Which explains the high level of quality and the total lack of food poisoning.
That's right. That's right.
It was actually really fun. I mean, a lot of these were sites, you know, you kind of vaguely breathe all this in through an American childhood, especially if you're, well, I mean, maybe boomer or old, or maybe we just missed it.
But you don't remember the bicentennial.
That's true.
And I do.
There's still bicentennial stuff on the trail. There's like, this is where Gerald Ford hung this historic thing.
Were there any Dennis the Menace, comic strips? So, because he really celebrated. Dennis the Menace really talked about the bicentennial a lot.
Syndicated feature newspaper comic strips always love that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I bet you could read 8 months of Croc that was just about the bicentennial, even though that doesn't make any sense in their Foreign Legion milieu.
BC was kneeling in front of the North Star and also with an American flag.
BC stands for Bicentennial Christ. So to you, it's a Dennis the Menace-based holiday.
Well, I mean, I just remember 1976, like, so profoundly because we celebrated it all year in school. Like, we were always doing...
There were tall ships.
Yeah, and we would do... All of our schoolwork had some connection to the bicentennial. So, and that was, what, second grade for me.
Well, I mean, that was kind of a foundational thing in American education for centuries. And you still see it today when you go to Disneyland or Disney World and you're like... Oh yeah, there was this Johnny Tremaine ass part of our culture that just kind of disappeared, and the bicentennial was kind of its last hurrah.
Yeah,
I have a historian friend who believes his personal theory is that it's the civil rights movement actually, not for woke or critical race theory, you know, or whatever the BS explanations are, but just because suddenly schools had like a new set of heroes fighting for American ideals.
That they could
point to, and it was in within living memory. Like, this is Rosa Parks, this is Dr. King. It didn't have to be like, let me explain to you Samuel Adams or Paul Revere, there's a horse. You know, all that kind of stuff starts to seem very pleasantly old-timey once there's a new kind of founding narrative of what our principles are.
You did go to school during a time when history class got to the 20th century the last week of school, and just raced through like, and then there's World War One, and then World War Two, and then it was over.
As late as high school, I was taking AP US History, and like, I think World War Two barely happened.
Yeah, right.
We won, it turns out.
Spoilers. Yeah, I definitely had multiple history classes that ended at World War Two and only covered that in the last.
Probably teachers. I mean, teachers' natural slowness, but also just love of Civil War and Revolutionary War stuff.
Right.
You know, they linger on the pilgrims that they fetishize.
Well, and it got really weird after the Korean War. Like,
right,
especially
how do you teach it?
In the 70s and 80s, like, wait a minute, this is very ambiguous, where everything before it was clear the Union had won.
But it was just funny kind of wandering around Boston, seeing these tour guides in tricorn hats. You know, I would sidle up to tours and get all the free scoop without paying. I was like, hey, that's Benjamin Franklin's dad's grave over there, and I didn't have to pay this dude with a bell, $28 plus tip.
Do they see you when you're on the fringe and scoff at you or glare at you?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I didn't follow them around. But it was a beautiful sunny Sunday in October, and there were enough of these guys out that, like, no matter which side I went to, somebody was there being like, this is the Parker Hotel. Ho Chi Minh and Malcolm X both worked in the kitchen. Uh-huh. And I was like, damn, that's pretty good. I mean, together?
What are they doing in the kitchen at the Parker Hotel?
They were actually like busboys. But, you know, just it all seemed so antiquated. Like, it seemed like a bygone America, not just in the sense that it happened hundreds of years ago, but just in the fact that we had last thought about tea parties and Boston massacres and midnight rides so long ago that it's not really celebrated so much. And, you know, because of the fact that a lot of those people, it turned out, owned hundreds of enslaved people. You can see why.
Although fewer in Boston.
Why the pivot to civil rights. Yeah, fewer in Boston, obviously.
Yeah, I think there's a Howard Zinnification of it, too. Like, in the 90s, once you read A People's History of the United States, it's hard to sing, well, shot heard round the world, was the start of the revolution. You know, like, you kind of lose the... the hagiography.
As we'll see, a lot of the history that got told about that time for centuries was a little bit selective and blinkered. You know, since Omnibus is often about forgotten memory holes of history, maybe the ultimate American Revolution memory hole is that it was effectively a civil war. We find ourselves in a divided nation where a lot of people are thinking back to the 1860s, you know, what would it look like again where a third to a half of the country is really ready to pack it in over slights or imagined slights.
But there's two thirds or at least a half of people that are like, it's fine.
Right. Even some of that side is actually, you know, is militant for other reasons, but there's a big chunk of people who are always going to be like, well, no, I mean, I'm with you, but, you know, sure, a lot of stuff's broken, but what, you want to start a new country? That's bananas. That's crazy.
Right.
And there was plenty of that during the Civil War, and we don't think about it, but...
The Revolutionary War. The,
no, I was going back to the Civil War, but then, you know, there was plenty of people, even in the Revolutionary War, who were like, no, I mean, it would be insane to try to launch a armed revolution against... a European monarch and his armies for various reasons will lose. You know, there's been an unsuccessful Jacobite rebellion just a few decades ago. The king's not going to lose. And also, like, what? For representative democracy? That's not a thing that exists. This all just seems science fictional. The idea that you would give up your prosperous situation in the biggest empire on earth to try a crazy new utopian scheme like democracy.
Well, and also the southern states and the northern states already hated each other, felt very little common bond, and had completely different cultures and desires.
This idea that we were all Americans is bogus because we weren't. We were all British subjects. They were all British subjects.
You.
Yeah. If I had been, I'm the reincarnation of, some page boy.
Alexander Pope.
For page boy for no, John
you're,
Hancock.
You're an elf. That's been widely established.
One of John Hancock's sheep. All these people did not think of themselves as Americans who were getting put down by a foreign government. They thought of themselves as British subjects who were getting sick of it and wanted to do their own thing. And that's a pretty big ask. It turns out that as many as, what would you say, you've probably heard of the idea of people who were loyal to the crown during the revolution, right? At least in the times leading up to it. Like famously, Benjamin Franklin's son was the royal governor of New Jersey and stayed loyal to the crown and I think hopped a boat back to Britain at some point. What's your sense of these people? Who were they?
Well, as you say, history has glossed over them because... in our retelling, they all ran to Canada, right? And that's why there is a Canada. It became a...
that's part of what happens at the end of the story.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No, but you're right. Like,
yeah,
the existence of Canada is largely, as a cohesive nation, is largely credited to this influx of disappointed losers.
Oh, I thought it was the deep love that the French had for the English. They were like, can't we make a country together? But you have to assume that, New York City was not united in its desire to leave the warm embrace of the mother country. Half the people there must have been like, come on, that's going to screw up trade. It's going to disrupt, you know, it's already making cocktail parties untenable. Like, because
everything about my life is pretty good. You know what's not good? Like a war in my living room, occupation of my city, disruption of my...
If you put any 20 people together, they're not going to agree even on whether to put cheese on hamburgers, let alone, you know, what the fate of the nation.
You know, we think of this as a real grassroots movement where everybody on the continent was eager to throw off the shackles. John Adams at the time famously said that a third of Americans or, you know, colonists supported the Patriot cause, a third were loyalists to the crown, and a third were neutral. So it's a pretty, you know, even set of buckets. We now think that Adams was maybe overestimating the amount of loyalty to the crown, but there probably were as many as 500,000 people living in the colonies who did not want a revolution and a new government and a new nation.
500,000 people in the colonies that had a population of 2.5 million?
Yeah, it's something. Yeah, it's on the order of, I don't know, 15 to 25% of white Americans at that time. And the stereotype we have of them is kind of what you say, people who did not want to see their income or elite status threatened. You know, in hindsight, we've painted all these people as kind of sycophantic, elite, yeah, money-grubbing merchants who were like, hey, are my servants going to leave me if there's a war?
They're always portrayed as effete.
Right.
And, you know, with beauty marks and...
You just saw Hamilton, right? Uh-huh. There's a scene where a guy when I saw it on Broadway, it was like one of the few unambiguously white members of the chorus plays this loyalist guy who gets up on a box and gives a stirring speech about how only the rabble would turn against their king. And then Hamilton appears and totally like stunts on him and does like a freestyle rap around his...
Right.
His lyrics, and, you know, based on, I'm sure, a real rap battle that probably took place in the streets of Boston. But that's the idea we have of these guys. They were all just kind of prissy, priggish British snobs,
right,
who were like, oh, boo-hoo, you know, what if I can't get my kippers because there's a war? And in fact, it was not even a coalition. It was like a crazy scattering of different kinds of Americans that largely opposed the war, and not all were men of property. You know, when you think about, there just weren't enough men of property in America to make a difference. The majority of loyalists would have been small farmers and artisans and shopkeepers, just because that's who the nation was. But a lot of them had professional jobs that they knew would have been threatened by war. You know, if you're a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer, you do not want to lose your government that's throwing you work.
Right. Although doctors thrive in a time of war.
Maybe, yeah.
They don't get paid as well.
Right. Those guys wanted to just give people poultices for their gout. You know, that's where the real money is.
But the Scots-Irish, right? They were poor and hated everybody, but hated the government in Pennsylvania as much or more than the British, right?
Sure. There were plenty of like little small marginalized groups who were against independence for their own reason. On the frontier, or what would have been backcountry, kind of Carolina and Georgia, there were plenty of people whose number one concern was, we need a strong colonial army protecting us in our wars with the Native Americans. You know, that was their number one threat to their security. And also, as it turned out, the number one threat to Native Americans. But from their point of view, it was like, we need redcoats in the hills or else we're going to get overrun.
Weirdly, those people are really setting the tone of American government right now.
They're clogging the airwaves.
Except
this time they're like, now, no, we need a new government. We need to go poop on Pelosi's desk ASAP.
Right.
But you're right. Back then, these were the same people who were, these were the ones who actually kind of founded their own little militias and started to get into skirmishes with their Patriot neighbors. And there actually were battles in Carolina and Georgia that were basically Americans against Americans. It was neighbor against neighbor, Civil War style stuff. At the Battle of Kings Mountain in Carolina, the four Goforth brothers faced off just on different sides of the battle, and three of them were on the Loyalist cause and one of them was on the Patriot cause, and they were all killed. And there were, you know, multiple of these Civil War kinds of stories in the backwoods down there. A British officer of some kind, Brigadier General maybe, named Tarleton, formed a Legion of Loyalists, which sounds like a pretty cool wrestling tag team or supervillain, whatever, where he got a lot of these angried up guys who were getting harassed by their neighbors and getting their barns burned down and said, hey, are you going to stand up for this? Like, so yeah, your state legislature way over there in Charleston says you're Americans now, but come on, who's with me? And they fought tooth and nail against their neighbors, against their own state.
It turned out they had mutant powers and they all lived in a big school.
Sadly, no, many died. But they were also just the most brutal fighters because they were not schooled in, you know, they were kind of doing the same kind of skirmishy guerrilla tactics that we now credit the Minutemen with, jumping out of the hills. After their leader, Tarleton came to be known as Tarleton's Quarter. That was a term for even once their enemies asked for quarter, you know, even once their enemies surrendered, they received Tarleton's Quarter, which was to get bayoneted.
Ah,
so
that's
the worst kind of quarter.
That's no quarter.
I think that's it's like a Hobson's Choice, a Tarleton's Quarter. So you had professionals with jobs who would have, you know, whose life would have been threatened. The interesting thing is all these educated people, they were good Enlightenment Lockean guys to the degree they had that education. They were like, oh, absolutely. Stamp Act sucks.
Right.
Intolerable acts are, I would say, intolerable. It's right there in the name.
Harumph, harumph.
Like these people were all 100% in lockstep with their patriot neighbors about the king and the parliament.
Right.
They were just like, hey, independence can't be seized. You know, like this is the worst possible outcome for our goals.
They were saying independence can't be seized, it has to be granted, or independence can't be seized, we need to reform from the inside.
I think more it would have to be, I mean, I think probably the second and then the first, you know, maybe there's, for a lot of them, maybe there's an eventual goal of, sure, you know, maybe we shouldn't be, but I think the first goal is we need to lobby the crown peacefully, yeah. You know, because, you know, cool minds will prevail and we'll see that these levies are unfair. And if we could just stamp out these little massacres that keep happening in the streets of Boston that are getting everybody angered up and getting all the torches and pitchforks out, this can all be avoided. You know, in a lot of ways, this sounds more like, it sounds less like left versus right in America today and more like leftists versus liberals.
Yeah.
Where kind of everybody agrees on the same progressive goals, but you've got some people who are like, hey, easy up on the rhetoric there.
Sure.
Buddy.
Sure, work within the system.
Work within the system.
I wonder if Machiavelli's The Prince was in wide circulation or whether it was still sort of in an untranslated state, because all of that is, you know, if that was a widespread text, you know, you can imagine that Sun Tzu wasn't in everybody's right. bookshelf. But was Machiavelli, it's kind
of... Well, what would the effect have been? He's pro-conniving. Does that mean he would have been more like, you can totally subvert this system from within?
No, I think he would say...
Or would he be pro-revolution?
You cannot grant freedom to someone because the grantor still retains the power.
Right.
To be granted freedom is no freedom. You have to seize your freedom.
And to be clear, I bet a lot of these loyalists would have been fine with that. Yeah, as long as the king is treating us square, as long as we're Jake,
right,
as they would have said, you know, it's fine. We can be part of the British Empire.
That's not a Jazz Age term, to be Jake?
No, people back then were always being Jake with something.
Wow.
It came from the Jacobites. Oh. No, that is not true. There were other groups, funnily enough, the Germans and the Dutch of Pennsylvania and upstate New York were extremely pro House of Hanover, I think largely because they were ethnically German. Like, yeah, we've got a good German king. The last thing we want is these ethnically English and Irish and other folks overrunning us.
You're here.
So, just like today. That's you and I as proud Welsh people, hoping to avoid the tyranny of the English and the Scots-Irish. So there were huge swaths of New York and Pennsylvania that were basically enemy territory during the Revolution. Like, whoa, you don't want to go there. You know, everybody there is kind of quietly pro George III.
Have you got any Dutch in you?
I don't think so.
Because I have some of that.
You're tall.
1620s Dutch in New York ancestry. And it always astonishes me how out of step it is, and they were from what we think of as like the colonists, or not out of step, but just other.
Yeah, they just had their own little. It was not a melting pot at all.
Right.
It was like, here's a little island of the Netherlands, right in the middle of the.
Well, but then it became a real melting pot because they had that Dutch, like, hey, you know, as long as it's business, everybody's welcome. So, but it was not a Brit. Well, it wasn't. Yeah. The melting pot of the,
like, linguistically and culturally, they retained a lot of their, and now that's mainstream American culture. We're even blind to
right.
What we think of as down home American Yankee stuff is actually straight up Netherlandish culture.
Yeah.
You know, all the
Stuyvesant houses,
all the tulips that we,
our lovely tulips here in Washington state.
The, Quakers tended to be anti-war. You know, we think of them as on the side of good progressive causes, but in this case, they were like, we should not be fighting for this questionable political outcome.
Right.
Down in Georgia, there were so many people who, I mean, here's what happened during the war. Like, once independence was declared in July 1776, Lexington and Concord had happened. It was pretty clear which way the wind was blowing. And, you know, even if a quarter or a third of America was loyalist, they just kept their heads down. You know, they kept it to themselves because people were getting tarred and feathered just under suspicion of not being true to the newly borning nation.
And that was something you could do. You didn't hang any flag out front. And you drew your blinds when people marched by and hoped that nobody would put you to a loyalty test or a loyalty to the revolution.
Do you think any of them had like the fake flags? Like, woo, yay. go get them at Saratoga, I hope.
I mean, I can't help but make the connection to what's happening in Ukraine now.
Yeah.
And you just think about it over and over. Like, you see those videos of the Ukrainian citizens Ukrainian soldiers moving into reoccupying territory, and all the residents come out and hug them, and they're all flying flags, and it's tear inducing, but
you're saying a third of those areas are ethnically Russian and not stoked about the new tanks.
Who knows who the people are that are just staying in their living rooms and not rushing out?
Like, if you watch the footage of the Russian tanks moving in and you look at the crowds welcoming them, it's probably there's a pretty good overlap of people, right?
Yeah, hard to know. I mean, it's so interesting to be readily consuming the propaganda of one side and utterly rejecting the propaganda of another side. It's impossible to discern.
I mean, the thing about, you know, you look in a mirror on this stuff about the loyalists during the revolution and you realize, honestly, to me, like, their cause actually seems the most sensible.
The loyalists.
Yeah. I'm not the one out here saying America's deeply broken to the barricades. You know, I'd be like, America's deeply broken. I'm going to write a letter to my congressman. I feel like in a matter of decades, we could incrementally take, really chip away at this problem.
America's deeply broken. I hope someone files a lawsuit.
Temperamentally, you know, and I'm, you know, by the same token, I'm economically comfortable. I'm not the one already living and dying on which student loans get repaid or whatever. So by virtue of that privilege, I'd probably be very much in the loyalist camp. I'd be getting tarred and feathered.
No.
During the revolution, it was funny, you know, the British would frequently retake cities. You know, they would retake Savannah or Charlestown or New York or whatever. And it didn't matter tactically because most of the population was rural at the time. You know, you retake a city and big deal. 90% of white America then is living out on farms. So tactically, that doesn't change your control over the country politically. But within the city, suddenly it was like, hey, where are my loyalists at? And all these people would be rounded up to, you know, help run the occupation efforts. They'd have positions within the government or within the military. You know, they'd get first crack at the supplies and they'd get their possessions back. And because there were a ton of confiscations, you know, as soon as first informally, like even before the declaration had been signed, you know, there were mobs tearing through Boston saying, hey, I heard this guy won't take down his lion and the unicorn, and they'd steal somebody's silver and tapestries burn down their barn or whatever it was. And then that became by force of law after the Continental Congress declared independence. Suddenly, if you were actually an out loyalist, you couldn't own property. All your stuff was getting confiscated. We've avoided one of the largest groups of loyalists just by the numbers, and it's maybe the most interesting case and one that I didn't know about because historians basically ignored it for centuries. Servants and slaves
were loyalists.
Were extremely loyal to the Tory cause. And there are some good new 21st century histories of this, but for hundreds of years, it was kind of ignored because on both sides of the political spectrum, it was unpopular to talk about servants and in particular black slaves being enslaved people being opposed to independence. On the from the abolitionist point of view in the 19th century, nobody wanted to remind anybody that these great new people who had done so much for the country actually had largely, because you're really kind of appealing to a white northern audience by pointing out the nobility of the oppressed.
Well, Crispus Attucks, I mean, we talk about him a lot.
So those are the stories you hear. But in fact, it was much more common for these people to be like, hell no, I'm not loyal to my owners. This is bull.
Sure. Although this is pre-abolition of slavery in the British Empire.
Yes, but there's some interesting asterisks there. There had been a case in the mid-18th century of a man named James Somerset, who was born in Africa, brought to Virginia and then Boston as a slave, and then followed his owner back to London, where his owner then baptized him. And because baptism often accompanied manumission at the time, Somerset began to live as a free man. His owner later decided, his putative owner later decided, no way, and took Somerset to court, being like, I'm a British subject. This dude is property. Somebody tell him his place. And the court kind of surprisingly found, no, if you baptized him and, he's been living this way for years, it's kind of like a eminent domain issue where this guy's a free man now. And it was a very limited finding. The court was really very clear to say, it's just because of these unusual cases, these unusual facts of the case that we find that James Somerset is no longer a slave. But it was widely reported as a court case finding against slavery. And word got around. Even in the colonies, word got around that, hey, did you hear about this guy, Somerset? Like, there's a British legal case saying this guy got away for a few years and now he's free.
So this is mid-18th century, so pre-
Yeah, this is around the time of the Revolution. The slaves already, there's kind of a widespread belief among enslaved people that the British are better on slavery issues.
Oh, I see.
Oh, and I didn't finish my thought before. Even though the abolitionist side kind of ignored this history because it didn't make enslaved people look like good, noble American patriots, from the other side, people who were more less sympathetic to abolitionism, their histories often omitted slavery in this area altogether. Like, you would think that, it was like a million people basically go missing in a lot of these histories. There's a famous 1891 Harvard case. In November 1775, a British governor in Virginia named Lord Dunmore announced that there would be freedom for all slaves who escaped from their masters and joined up with the British.
Oh.
And, subsequent historians have said, relations between masters and slaves were so pleasant in Virginia at this time.
Slaves were pretty happy.
These are literally the words of a leading Harvard historian in 1891. This was the kind of mainstream history that American students were dealing with. Was like, it was also good and benign. Like, this isn't just like covert in Gone with the Wind. This is genuinely what historians were saying. That Dunmore's invitation generally fell on dull, uninterested ears.
Wow.
So he really conveys not just that the masters are great, but the enslaved people are just a bunch of dimwits.
Well, you have to wonder how the information was transmuted in the sense that,
like, how did the slaves get that word?
Hey, let me show you the newspaper.
But there must have been a grapevine, because enslaved populations did hear, hey, if word got around, this is a lot easier now. All we have to do is get behind British lines, and as those lines of engagement ebbed and flowed over the course of revolution, there were a ton of runaway slaves. Maybe, what is this number I have down? Maybe 100,000 people? Could that be 1 in 5 American slaves? Half a million people? Actually sought escape and sought refuge under the British aegis at this time. The story is often told in terms of a man born in Gambia named Harry Washington, because he was one of George Washington's slaves. He was brushing horses in the stables at Mount Vernon when he hears, hey, have you heard what Lord Dunmore just said? If we can just get, across the river or whatever, we're good. And he immediately takes off, you know, despite General Washington at the time saying things like, you know, this is all good. Dunmore's propaganda won't work on our happy, happy population of workers. In fact, he was privately writing to his brother, like, this is going to be a nightmare. Like, if they get a taste of liberty, they're never going to want it back. So Washington takes off and joins what's called the Black Pioneers, a unit of the British Army, a British militia organized as support troops against the colonialists during the Revolution. It turns out that Washington was very unhappy with his new post. The Black Pioneers ended up doing, they were basically garbage men.
Yeah.
It was basically kind of support work meant cleaning nuisances from the street.
He went from brushing horses to shoveling shit.
That's exactly right. But that's a state of affairs that lasted throughout the Revolution. And when Cornwallis finally surrendered at Yorktown, it got even more dire because suddenly thousands of enslaved people are like, oh, this is our last chance. We need to either get to the French. Now, there was still slavery in New France, of course, on their plantations. Later on, Robespierre would ban slavery. Napoleon briefly brought it back on the sugar plantations and then abolished slavery again. But at the time, slavery was not allowed in European France. So I think a bunch of these people were thinking, look, if I can just get on a boat, I'll be a street sweeper or a shoe polisher on the streets of Paris, but anything's better than this.
Yeah.
So people trying to get to French lines or trying to get behind English lines being like, hey, is that offer still good? Like, how do we get out of here? So by contemporary accounts, herds of Negroes, that's the quote, headed out through the cypress swamps away from their masters, hoping to get to freedom. And, you know, of course, most of them did not. Many were caught. There's an awful case of a woman who was caught who gets lashings are ordered, and then before the wounds can be healed, her master orders hot embers pressed into the scars. So, you know, by the strongest possible terms, the slave owners were really hoping to keep their population at home. But
and how did the British, as the British retreated onto their ships, did they take a portion of?
It's a Saigon. It's a Saigon-like scenario where everybody's trying to get to the ports, got to get to Savannah or Charleston or New York or whatever it is before the last British boats leave. Pregnant women are running through the forest, hoping to get there before they can get captured by, you know, and suddenly there's an army of slave catchers now, hoping to stay ahead of them. But also they don't want to give birth too fast, because if they can give birth in British-held territory, they'll get this coveted BB stamp for their baby, you know, like born behind British lines. Oh. Because as part of the armistice negotiated, one of the terms was that these formerly enslaved people who had been freed by the British would be allowed to board ships in many cases.
All of this is happening in the colonies below the Mason-Dixon line.
Right.
Right? There's not, you know, this all was precipitated by your visit to Boston, but there was not a huge slave population in Boston.
No, but let's see. At the time, I mean, I assume enslaved people were still accompanying their masters north. It wasn't like the situation decades later where if you could just get across a certain river, you'd be good, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
I think there were kind of broad protections.
But there were free blacks in New York and
yes,
in Boston. And,
yes. Yeah, there were some. And as a result, when these newly freed black people got on these boats headed out, Washington had ordered that a Book of Negroes be kept.
The Book of Negroes?
Yeah, no longer in print, I think, which would actually keep track of, hey, you know, tell me your name. Where did you? The idea was that former slave owners could receive compensation at some point from the crown.
Oh.
If we were going to seize their, you know, if we were going to look the other way while their property heads out.
And did the British just first dock in the Bahamas and kick everybody off, or did they really go back to London?
A lot of people wound up in the UK. I mean, some of these people, a big percentage of them just became part of that wave up to Canada. Yeah. You know, after the war, somewhere between 10 and 20% of the US population took off. They were like, no, thank you. We were always loyal to the crown. This is no longer Britain. Let's go to the land the British still hold. So suddenly, somewhere
within 20 miles of the American border.
Right. 60 and 100, just like they live today. Somewhere between 60 and 100,000 people suddenly find Nova Scotia very appealing.
Interesting.
Which back then would have included everything down to New Brunswick, I think. And it was a weird vibe up there because the people who had already settled there did not like or want them there. A lot of them wound up in Quebec, where they would, they were actually ordered by the governor of Quebec. They would get like a, you know how like you can get like initials after your name, to show some kind of order of merit in the British Empire. The governor of Quebec ordered that all these, loyalists coming from what were now the United States would receive UE after their name. Cause they were United Empire loyalists. And for decades thereafter, a lot of the best families would proudly put a UE after their name to show that they had been against the cause of American independence and were therefore good citizens. In the South, thousands headed south into Florida, which was then held by the Spanish, many into the Caribbean.
The Spanish famous for their abolitionism
and just the rights of man. Good treatment of ex-slaves. Same in the Caribbean. But you're right. You know, because of that, many of these thousands of freed blacks who'd gotten aboard the British ships ended up heading north. You know, the British were like, well, what are we going to do about this? You know, now that they weren't a propaganda piece anymore, the British military didn't, and the empire did not care about these newly freed slaves. They ended dumping a bunch of them in Nova Scotia, basically on land that nobody else wanted. Everybody, you know, a lot of other people got free land grants. You know, the British offered free land. You know, they wanted to get their good people out and keep that elite mercantile class functioning in British Canada. So cash, £3 million in British money and free land were given out to give these people a new start, but not, as you'll imagine, the free slaves. They were kind of put on the bad soil that nobody wanted in Nova Scotia. And 1500 of them formed, including Harry Washington, founded Birchtown, but they got
there. Is it still a majority black town?
It would be a great story. It would be a great story.
It would.
No, they got there so late in the year they couldn't plant crops, and it turned out to just be an even worse version of all the terrible Jamestown and Plymouth stories where there's nothing to eat and people are killing their dogs and cats to try to make it through the winter. As a result, a lot of those people ended up, including Harry Washington, ended up in the next repatriation effort, which was, let's get these guys back to Africa and solve the whole problem. Which is something that's an idea that kept having currency for maybe the next century.
Yeah.
But at this time it was particularly crazy because there was still a slave trading, industry. So yeah, let's just put these people right back on the West African coast.
There was no Liberia.
What
yet.
Could go wrong? Yeah. So all these people got dumped in Sierra Leone, and immediately, as you'd expect, the local slave trading tribes found them, and a lot of them just went right back to Caribbean or New World slavery. So they
I would think at
could
least
not catch a break.
Their understanding of English and their American roots would have made them slavery entrepreneurs themselves.
I wonder if that did happen.
Taking over the slave trade, like, no, here's how it actually goes.
We've seen a lot of the inefficiencies, and we at this point, we know which side of the ledger we would like to be on.
Right.
I mean, you could hardly blame them.
That's an unwritten history I'd like to know more about.
I mean, the people are talking about it, and I mean, you get a lot of these internet edgelords who are mad about that Viola Davis movie, The Woman King, because... did you follow the discourse?
No, my daughter's mother just went to see it and said that it was very good and exciting.
I saw it last week. It's really good. There's a lot of, you know, kind of training montages, and it kind of works as a war movie. But apparently the tribe that's depicted there, the Dahomey, were actually the ones who were, the reason why they're the prosperous ones in the area is because they were the ones profiting by the slave trade.
So often
these brave women warriors were like being exercised by the king in defense of their slave trading prestige and prowess.
And what was the edgelord hot take?
Oh, just that, Hollywood wants you to like this movie because it's got women of color in it. But guess what?
What?
They're all actually the bad guys. It was a pretty superficial take. But 10 to 20% of the white residents of North America, of the former British crown colonies there, took off. They did not want to
take off,
live in America. Yeah.
That's where that came from.
That's, do you think that's why the current Canadians are so polite and apologetic? Because they're the ones who are like, no, thank you. We don't actually, we'd be better off maybe without all this independence. It's fine. You guys can do that. We're just going to go over here.
I have a couple of friends that live in Ottawa who I'm on a little text thread with them where they're saying that they don't want to live in Ottawa anymore. They feel like
because
the culture of Ottawa has gone into the garbage dump. And
I need to know more about the high point of Ottawan culture, maybe, to understand this.
Yeah, I mean, all of my visits to Ottawa, it was just as plain as oatmeal with no sugar.
It just looks like a government capital, you know.
But now I guess it's, I don't know what the problem is. Honestly, I don't understand Canadians when they talk. It's very, or even when they text.
Like the vowels or like their thought process?
Yeah,
You're not sure if they're sentient?
No. I'm like, so are you mad about, what are you mad about? And then they're like, oh, I'm not mad. It's like, well, wait, you sounded mad a second ago. No. Never mind.
I shouldn't have done that. You almost scratched the surface and got the real. This is like some Star Trek Alien of the Week thing where like in the first act, you're like, what is going on under the surface with these people? But you have not yet discovered the roiling, you know, they've got a computer in a cave telling them what to do or whatever.
I know Canadians get upset. I've seen it, but then they immediately, they back right off. So it might be, yeah, it might be.
There's a computer under a cave in Ottawa that's telling them all what to do.
It could be that they were the ones that didn't get upset about taxation without representation.
Then
it's just through the process of selective breeding, they've just become less and less able to be mad.
But think about the loyalists. You wouldn't be for these guys either. Like when you see people on cable news who are like wearing tricorn hats and being like, the IRS and the government is unfair to me. I'm starting my own country. Here's a new flag I made. You know, you and I are never like, yeah. These guys know what's up.
Well, no, but you know, the thing about the, what we would lovingly refer to as the radical left is that they also are ready for a revolution and believe that they would be the triumphant class.
Well, you know, we've got 78% of the economy and we've got all the knowledge workers and
zero of the guns.
I think they're assuming they would keep the armed forces.
Yes, right. I think a misunderstanding.
As we all see in the Western Hemisphere, you know, the armed force is always on the side of the...
Well, and it's funny because I think that the misunderstanding is that the armed forces are intrinsically conservative, which in a way they are, but like having met a lot of military people, I don't think that the problem is that they're all Tea Party kooks. I think there are a lot of smart, like moderate liberals in the army. It's just the intellectual property of the flag, the Constitution, which...
That's going to be used by whoever's in...
Exactly. Yeah. And the left is in a moment right now where they're like they're rejecting all of that intellectual property because they find that it is connected to distasteful ideas in the past. So they're like, we need a new constitution. The problem is the army answers to the constitution. So the people on the right who have never even read the constitution are like, the constitution! But if we surrender it to them without a fight.
That's why you see people putting the American flag in their emoji, but then you click on them and they've also got, they put the American flag emoji in their social media heading, but then you click on them and they've also got pronouns or whatever.
Oh, good. Yeah, right. I mean, let me just advocate
reclaim the flag
that people who are on the liberal side of the spectrum not abandon the intellectual property of the United States of America.
I feel like we're good. It's the other people that have like stars and bars and coil don't tread on me snakes on the back of their trucks. They're the ones like
Blue Lives Matter
flags.
They're
the ones picking the failed flags. I mean, the Blue Lives Matter one is smart because it does, you know, it's at least in monochrome, it reminds you of the American flag.
Yeah, right. Yeah, if you have a Confederate flag in your emojis, are there even Confederate flag emojis?
Ooh, I don't think so. If I type racism on my iPhone, what will it autocomplete with?
Well, what it'll do is you'll start getting Google ads for things that you don't want.
For racism. The thing about all these people, including a huge chunk of this elite mercantile class, big plantation owners and so forth, clearing out to Canada, was that suddenly the playing field was leveled after the war. And there was, you know, there were a few decades where it was a great time to be a striver in upstate New York or, you know, plantation Virginia or Carolinas or whatever, because a lot of the old money had cleared out. And, and so all the fine old families of your part of America were gone.
Sure. The fancy, but slow-witted ones.
Right. And now you could be the new Mayflower people if you moved in. So there were, you know, a couple of decades of kind of like the equivalent maybe of post-war Eisenhowerian prosperity where, you know, a striver could really pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Well, it's funny because there's all this legend of the first families of Virginia, right? It's part of the American, particularly the Southern origin story of the country, the first families of Virginia, and they're some countable number, and they all intermarried with one another, and the Washingtons are among them. But it had never occurred to me that that list of first families was culled at some point to eliminate the ones that had actually been among them and now, you know, decamped.
The ones who took their ball and went.
Yeah. So
if not home, at least to Quebec.
In 1790, they took that roster and crossed a bunch of names off of it.
Yeah. When the revolution comes, John, are you headed for Quebec, Nova Scotia? Do you have a place in mind? Prince Edward Island?
No, I don't want to go to Quebec. I think I'll go to Alaska.
Oh,
where,
yeah.
Where I will be a member of a royal clan, an ancient storied family. And of course, global warming will make it also a temperate paradise there.
Yeah, and no Celine Dion music. It's perfect.
And that concludes Loyalists, entry 738.1S0819, certificate number 13747 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, get off of it immediately. How many times do I have to tell you?
What are you thinking?
I'm back on it all the time because of the war in Ukraine, and I'm such a fanboy of.
I like how you're going to blame the war in Ukraine on all your problems.
It is.
Well, of course I've gained 10 pounds. It's the war in Ukraine.
It's the war in Ukraine. I'm so fascinated by fellas and HIMARS that I have to look at it 50 times a day. But you don't have to look at it. You can go back to your regular lives, as I hope to do one day soon. But while you're there, you can check out at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, and at John Roderick. It will seem like at John Roderick isn't very active, but I'm lurking there. And Ken, you have stopped being as nutty, right? You've straightened up now that you're a major media figure, a national figure.
I would say I'm on Twitter quite a bit less. Yeah. Part of that for reasons of self-care.
Yes.
But also, yeah, like I'm now speaking for a major media franchise.
But finally, you're practicing self-care after all these years of me trying to get you to read The Secret.
Yeah, you and I should go get mani-pedis.
You can email us. And Mindy Jennings will read it at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. And then the ones that are interesting, she'll show to Ken. And then the ones that...
I actually read them all. People now, because you always do this shtick, people now email us and are like, hey, Mindy, could you tell Ken?
And then only rarely does Ken forward me one. And it's usually somebody saying, actually, there are four engines on that airplane. And I'm like,
you think I want to read that crap?
Don't I get emails that are like, John, you're amazing.
Why should I have to read that crap?
Wedding proposals.
Send all your emails about how John is amazing. I promise to forward those along.
Thank you. You can mail us actual things. I was wearing that satin jacket that came in the mail the other day with the beer label with a giant elk on the back.
Yeah.
I found it in the closet and I was like, who left their jacket here? And then I pulled it out and I was like, oh, right. And I put it on. I wore it all day and I felt super cool. So mail us things at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. It sounds like you're opening mail over there.
I am, but whoever sent this, I believe, sent it straight from Amazon and did not...
No note?
Did not include... Oh, no, there is a note. Here we go. Oh, Tim wants us to celebrate our 500th episode with a fun... book. If you type the word 500 into Amazon, you can see a bunch of options. So he sent us his favorite 500 Godzilla facts. a book self-published by James Egan, a guy who looks like a guy you'd expect to be self-publishing books about.
That's
Kaiju.
That's just as interesting and looks just as good as all those books about Seattle where it's like, the history of right. Wallingford.
Take a walk through Ballard. Here's what we're going to do. You need to name a number between 1 and 500, and we will hear the corresponding Godzilla fact.
272.
Oh, that's a terrible one. Actually, it is. Here's fact number 272. Terror of Mechagodzilla 1975 was the last Godzilla movie of the original series before it was rebooted. See, I didn't know that. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
See, we've learned a lot from fact number 272.
All right, what's your number going to be?
108. Let's see. At one point in King Kong versus Godzilla, four octopi attack Kong. Hot air was blown on the octopi to force them to move. Oh.
Oh, real octopi?
Yeah.
But we say octopuses because we understand that that's...
The Greek root is not blah, blah, blah. Right. Octopodes. After the octopi finished their scenes, they were released back into the ocean, except one who was eaten by the crew.
Oh.
See, that doesn't happen on a Tarantino set.
No, I wonder if they rolled the dice on it or they just picked the fattest one or what?
The most delicious looking, or maybe the one that was not actually very good in the movie. Like, yeah. This guy was blowing all his cues. He's stealing focus. He's going to be sashimi.
All right. What's 333?
Fact number 333 about Godzilla. The tagline of Godzilla versus Destoroyah 1995 was... Godzilla dies. Wow.
But
is that true?
Is that true?
Apparently not, because he came back in 1999's Godzilla Millennium. So, I mean, he can cheat death, perhaps.
Sure.
Godzilla makes a deal with Satan. If he can fight King Kong and, you know, and Ghidra and all them. What's
Godzilla,
the name? Mothra?
Godzilla.
Surely he can stand up against Satan. Thank you for sending that, Tim.
Thank you, Tim. If you would like to hang out with other Futurelings, you can. They are on the internet. You could probably go on the internet and actually put together a in-person Futurelings hangout somewhere.
You can talk about Godzilla facts at the bar.
Yeah, we've learned that there are Futurelings almost everywhere. So even if you live in a small town somewhere in Western Australia, if you put the word out, I bet you'll find another Futureling that would meet you for coffee. Now, whether or not you get along, I can't say. Whether or not there's any chemistry or attraction between you?
Probably not. A lot of misanthropic weirdos listening right now.
That's right. It's always unlikely that any two people will fall madly in love.
A lot of cranks.
Like Khal Drogo and the Khaleesi. Or Khaleesi. She's not the Khaleesi. Although that is a title, right? She could be the Khaleesi.
She could.
Khal Drogo and Khaleesi.
You should rewatch this show and get more intel on that.
You know, the thing about Khaleesi is she said, look, I don't want to just be Khal Drogo's concubine. I'm his wife and princess, and I'm going to flip him over and do some kissing on him. And boy, is that a hot scene. Episode one or two, right away.
Gets going right away.
You're like, this is a sexy show.
That dude's about to get gold on his head. Why are you calling her Khaleesi instead of whatever her name is? Daenerys.
Daenerys Targaryen?
Can't we just call her Daenerys?
Well, because she starts calling herself Khaleesi, and that's what Jorah Homegarden says.
Use people's chosen names.
Yeah, that's right. She says Khaleesi.
I'm sure his name is Jorah Homegarden.
Well, Jorah. What he was Jorah of the Homegardens.
Ian Glenn, Jorah Mormont?
Mormont. There you go.
Maybe.
Yeah, he calls her Khaleesi, and so, you know. That must be her preferred name.
Yeah, he's kind of a cult member, though.
Because she's not like, I'm reinstituting the Targaryen. Anyway.
Is this your determination to make this the one outro that no one makes it to the end of?
Wee! And if you want to support the show, which I hope you do, verily forsooth, go immediately to patreon.com/omnibusproject. Was this a fan-suggested show, or did you come up with this on your own?
It was not. This was me wandering through Boston, wondering about all the anti-loyalist slurs I was hearing from the tricorn hats.
Yeah. Oh, they were slurring the loyalists. Rightfully so.
Well, they just mostly get left out of the story, you know? Like, if John Adams thought a third of the country was on the other side and they never get mentioned?
They're still around. They're still there. When you meet people,
they're hunkered down.
Yeah, look them up and down. You know, if European Americans.
Hey, what do you think about the Boston Tea Party? And see what they say.
Exactly.
Hey, you fired up about Crispus Attucks?
Did it make sense to you to throw the tea in the pond, or did you feel like it was a waste of tea? So yes, support the show there at patreon.com/omnibus.
Hey, let's take this opportunity to talk a little bit about the future of Omnibus in the year 2023.
Yeah, there's going to be one significant change, and it will maybe startle our listeners at first.
And annoy them.
But I think that it will, in the long run, be something that that is good for the show and good for everyone.
John is going to get a Roomba, and he's going to talk about it a lot.
Every time we're going to do a Roomba ad at the start of the show that lasts for 20 minutes.
We've had a lot of concern from listeners saying, hey, if Ken's now got a full-time job in LA, is this bad news for Omnibus? And the answer is yes and no.
I have to say that when Ken got finally tapped after everyone else was
destroyed by fire, by dragons.
That, but also, you know, 2 years after everybody else understood and agreed that you should be the host of Jeopardy, when Jeopardy finally agreed, Ken moved a big golden throne into our recording studio, and now he sits a full foot higher than me, and it does affect
the quality of the show. It's in the shape of an Emmy. It's very uncomfortable to sit on. We got...
oh my God, when you get an Emmy, you are going to be so intolerable. You're intolerable already, but...
Have you not seen my Emmy? That's why I'm intolerable.
You have an Emmy?
Yeah.
When did you get an Emmy?
Did we not talk about this? I had that BS producer, consultant producer credit. And the daytime Emmys will just send Emmys out to anybody with any producer in their name because the daytime Emmys were largely financed by statuette purchases.
Really?
Yeah, the show, like Young and the Restless would be like, okay, we need 68 Emmys. And they'd be like, sweet, those are $800 each. And that's a lot of what funded the daytime Emmys.
This is why daytime
Emmys are not picky about it.
If you get an EGOT, but it has a daytime Emmy, you have an asterisk by it.
Probably E asterisk got.
Because I down there at Como TV, you know, I went through their studio one time and there were like 40 Emmys in a case, and I was like, whoa! And then somebody like leaned over and was like, yeah, they're daytime Emmys.
Those are, I mean, a lot of them might be. There might be like regional Emmys.
Oh, even worse.
It might be even lower. I'm not sure. Is it like the regional Tonys?
How did I not see the Emmy? Is it? Oh, it's tucked in behind the key to the city of Syracuse that you have on your...
It's on my mantelpiece now next to those Matryoshka dolls I didn't give you. I'll send you a picture. Anyway,
so let's cut to the chase. It's too late now, but let's try and cut to the chase.
Like, we got behind on Omnibus this summer when we were traveling, and usually we get back ahead in the fall, but with all the TV commuting I was doing, we are still struggling to keep our heads above water, which means that Omnibus is going to continue in 2023. That's the good news.
Yay!
But the only way to do it is to do it as a weekly show. So there will be one Omnibus a week beginning in January. Hopefully that gives us time to keep ahead of the show and make sure the shows can be long and rambling for the foreseeable future.
Yay!
And not time constrained, because we were really we're having a hard time figuring out how to do two a week.
Yeah, it was beating us up because Ken was gone, and then, you know, all it took was that that I was gone to throw us completely up.
Yeah, as long as you never left,
yeah,
we were okay.
But sometimes I leave.
Sometimes you leave.
Sometimes I just show up so drunk we can't even record.
Sometimes you're walking across Europe and I have to do both the voices.
I want to say to the listeners, fear not. Every time I say to Ken, you're not going to leave Omnibus, are you? He gives me a very stern and sincere look and goes, I love doing Omnibus. I'm never going to quit doing Omnibus, ever.
I'm not fleeing to Nova Scotia.
When we are 75 years old, we're still going to be meeting in this bunker and recording this show, even after I'm a multi-millionaire who's feted at all the network TV parties.
I feel like at one point we were like, are we going to keep doing Omnibus? And I said, well, if we don't, we'll just... we'll probably just like meet for lunch once a week and do this anyway. Yeah. So why not record it?
Exactly. Hey, Ken, let me tell you all about Laika, the dog that went to space.
So that's beginning in January. Omnibus will end its bi-weekly, what do we have, 4 or 5 year run? 5 year run, I think.
Yeah, and I imagine.
And we'll begin a new weekly life.
There are maybe the majority of our listeners struggle to keep up with a 2 podcast a week schedule.
Who does that?
Well,
who does that? Who does 2 a week? We're insane.
probably nobody records two podcasts a week, but you know, there are listeners that are on a weekly commute that where the commute is an hour and 13 minutes long. But also, yeah, people put us on to play in the background while they have sex with their spouse.
But you can put on an old show for that. It might make the sex better.
Right.
Maybe not more intense, but maybe warmer, you know?
Yeah. Well,
more intimate.
Our cadence might have been different. Like there might be somewhere I've had a lot of coffee and you're feeling really jazzed and the tempo is a lot.
Are you saying that's better for sexual congress or worse?
Some kinds. You know, there are a lot of different varieties of sex.
Somebody needs to index the shows according to cadence.
Yeah, right.
If that's what you're interested in.
I'm sure that there is a computer program that can take spoken word and like attribute
a BPM.
A tempo to it. Yeah. Anyway, so don't be scared. Don't be sad. We're going to once a week. It's going to be great.
This is what keeps Omnibus going. And we definitely want to make sure that happens.
And all we're doing is just becoming a normal podcast and not one that is like insanely hard to make.
Our previous Omnibus on Speed podcast will end in December. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that catastrophe that we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.